Hey everybody, it's me, W. Kamau Bell, stand-up comic, TV host, filmmaker, dad, pretty good husband, and interim director of the ACLU's podcast, At Liberty! I went to the Oprah School of Talking. Today we're speaking with Emmy-nominated actress, author, trans advocate Nava Mao, and board-certified gynecologist Dr. Susan Lacey. What, you might ask, could bring the three of us together? Well, on December 4th, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear a case about when, where, and how the government can discriminate against transgender people. The case comes down to a 2023 Tennessee law that bans medical treatments like puberty blockers and hormones for trans youth. In other words, if you're not transgender, you already have access to these medications. But if you are trans, you do not. The ACLU and the Justice Department will argue that the ban is unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which says the government cannot discriminate on the basis of sex. And the Tennessee ban isn't an isolated attack. It's part of a larger effort to silence, marginalize, and erase transgender lives. The 2024 legislative session was the fifth consecutive record-breaking year for total anti-trans bills, and Tennessee's healthcare ban is one of 24 just like it passed in 2021. Surveys tell us that most people don't even know a transgender person, let alone have familiarity with their healthcare. Just like with abortion, birth control, or even vaccines, the lies about gender-affirming medical care are spreading far and wide. Dr. Susan Lacey has practiced medicine for almost 30 years. In the upcoming Supreme Court case, she's a plaintiff challenging Tennessee's ban on behalf of her practice and her transgender patients. Today, I'm speaking with her and the actress Nava Mao to talk about what this health care means in practice and why it's so important for transgender people. Thank you for taking your time out of your busy schedules, both of you, to do this. Thank you for having here, and thank you for showing up for the ACLU in all the ways that you do. So thank you. So I'm coming to you both from Oakland, California. We're here in Oakland, California. Nava, you spent time in Oakland, huh? Is that true?
I did, and I was actually just there a few days ago. I went for the premiere of this documentary I executive produced called Survivor Made.
Oh, wow. And you lived here for a while, correct?
Yes, yeah. I was there for about 4 years. It was kind of where everything happened. It's where I transitioned, actually. So it's very fitting. And I have a really, really, really huge place in my heart for Oakland.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's good to know. When I was watching Baby Reindeer, first of all, let me tell you, this show's good. I don't know if you've heard that, gotten that feedback, Nava, that the show is entertaining and good. when I was watching that, when you came on screen, but I was so, at this moment of like, wait, who is this person who just exploded on the screen that I'm not familiar with their work before? And so I had to pause and sort of like do a deep dive on you in the middle of watching the show, just because I was so, the show is so quirky and doing its own thing. And you felt like such a force of nature in that show. So I just really want to compliment you and your work that it actually made me pause and figure out who is this person? I can't pay attention until I know who this person is. So thank you for your work.
Thank you. That is so sweet. That really means the world. I've been a fan of yours for so long. So this is like, I'm getting a little bit of goosebumps right now.
That makes me feel good. Thank you. Now I'm getting reverse goosebumps. So thank you for your work. And I know as a person who, I always joke that my mom, being a black woman with a college degree who was born in 1937, everywhere she went for the first half of her life, she was the first black woman to do whatever that was, you know, just because that's where America was. You're the first black woman to take a left turn on the street. You know, it's just because the way that America's set up. And sometimes that history can be it can feel burdensome. Like, I just want to do my thing. How do you live with that history when you're also just a person?
You know, I think that the reality is that I don't feel like a first. I do all that I do within community. I started out with a short film that was crowdfunded on a micro budget, and I was not the only trans woman working on that project. I have always worked in community organizations, and my mentors have been, you know, trans women. And so we've always been here, and we always will. And any sort of recognition as one of us being the first is actually just the perspective of a cis person seeing us for the first time, but we've seen ourselves all along.
Yeah, no. And Dr. Lacey, you're in this position of being a doctor, but is also, and this is another thing I think, that as Black folks, we also have to be activists no matter what our job is, it seems like, that you can't just show up and do your job. You have to show up and do your job and also do the job of liberating your people and liberating other people. How do you balance those two things?
Yeah, and just the other little Oakland shout out is I grew up in Sonoma County, so I have spent plenty of time, yeah. So I grew up in Santa Rosa, and so I spent, you know, time in Oakland as well. So that's cool that we're all sort of have that connection. Yeah, it's interesting. It's one of those things where when I and we can talk about this more, but I started providing trans hormone care about 8 years ago. I've always really been interested in hormone management. That's something that I find very interesting. And so when you do this, you sort of, so what I did, I sort of said, okay, well, this is what we're going to do. And so I sometimes say it's kind of an accidental activist because I didn't really go into it thinking, you know, oh, well, this is going to be something that I'm going to, you know, get out there and be in the forefront. I just was interested in taking care of people. And then the more people I took care of, the more people needed care. And so then people start asking you about it. And then you start, you know, giving lectures or doing educational stuff with medical students and residents. And, you know, one thing just sort of leads to another. So then you sort of have the point of, okay, now you're the person, now you're the point person, now you're the activist. And I'm like, I'm just trying to do this and take care of people and, you know, do my job, basically. So.
Well, thank you. Nava, I see you nodding your head a lot. I want to know what is behind all those head nods I see as Dr. Lacey was talking.
Well, I'm an active listener, first and foremost, so just taking it in. But I really, it does resonate with me, everything you just said, Dr. Lacey. You know, we end up doing work that becomes politicized. And for me, creative work starts from my heart. You know, it starts in my body. It's not something that I do to become part of some sort of legislative battle. That's not, you know what I mean? That's not what drives me, you know. Freedom is ultimately what I strive for, whether that's freedom of expression or freedom to exist. And so any sort of political battle that gets placed on top of that work, I really see that as coming externally, and it's like an added layer that we have to deal with. But that's not what the real work is actually about.
Yeah, and I would say as well, you know, like I said, I started about 8 years ago, and there was very little sort of political discussion. It was, you know, a little bit, but you know, in the last several years, all of a sudden, it's turned into this huge political issue, which is sort of strange. I mean, we understand why that happens, but it's a little bit strange because it's not like people haven't been providing this care. So for me, it's like, well, 8 years ago, I was providing this care and there were no issues. And then all of a sudden, it's an issue. And you're kind of, you know, I mean, I understand why it happens, but you also kind of go, well, people have been doing this for a long time. And a lot of patients have been receiving care for a long time. Nothing has really changed except for sort of the visibility. And some of that is very much manufactured to create conflict.
Well, speaking of manufactured visibility to create conflict, I feel like it's currently in the news, and Representative Nancy Mace is walking around the halls of Congress putting the sign biological over the women's bathroom in Congress, directly targeting Sarah McBride, I believe her name is, the just newly elected congressperson. What goes through your mind, what goes through your body when you see this, you know, see things like that happening, where this clearly, this congressperson is actively weaponizing, is what I would say, this idea just as a way to get attention?
I mean, the whole issue, again, is somewhat, it's artificial and manufactured because, you know, if she didn't know that this person identified as trans, she wouldn't have any idea that there was somebody trans in the bathroom with her, right? And so you know, it becomes an issue of fake outrage. And, you know, one of the things that I always say about bathrooms is so tricky is I have patients who maybe have been on masculinizing therapy for, you know, 10 years, have a full beard, have had top surgery. And now if they walked into a room and you had to ask the average person to identify their sex and gender, most people would definitely identify this as a male person. And now this person has to decide, well, do I go into the bathroom that legally I'm supposed to go into? Or do I go into the bathroom that people are going to feel comfortable with me in? And it creates a scenario in which everybody is a policeman. You know, everybody is sort of judging this person's identity by what they look like on the outside. And, you know, that's so problematic because, first off, why does it matter? But secondarily, it really is tricky for people who are trying to make a value judgment of where they feel comfortable being and are they going to be safe? And, you know, again, it's an argument about something that is, you know, was never a problem and isn't a problem, but it's a way to create outrage.
Yeah. Nav, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's manufactured outrage for sure. It, I think, also is an extension of the surveillance state and any kinds of efforts to legislate and police access to public bathrooms are only meant to normalize the policing of people's bodies and to normalize what will come of enforcement of any kind of bathroom bills. Like, how are people going to be verified as suitable to use any one bathroom or the other? These kinds of bills are going to affect cis people, you know, just as much and sometimes more so than trans people. Like, people's genitals are going to be verified. Are people going to have to carry ID at all times? That's police state stuff. And so this is just one of the ways that the conservative government right now is trying to amplify the police state.
Yes. Dr. Lacey, let's talk about the case that you're a plaintiff in that is going to the Supreme Court, which is just like, I don't often talk to people who are going to the Supreme Court. So first of all, yay! That's quite an accomplishment, even though it's got to be scary. Can you talk about what your feeling is around going to the Supreme Court? And also, like, tell us about the case.
Yeah. So, well, first let me say, like, I'm not the person that's doing all the hard work, of course, you know. And so basically, in a brief summary, back 2 years ago, I went to a meeting here where I live in Memphis, Tennessee, talking about this law that was being argued about in the state legislature about limiting trans care for minors. And then I met some of the ACLU leaders in the state. And then once the law was passed, that bans trans care for minors. They reached out to me and we talked and discussed, you know, the ACLU along with Land Illegal filed suit against the state to prevent this law from going into effect. And so that's where it all started. And so ultimately, the law was initially overturned by the local, you know, state judge, and then it was appealed to the appellate court, who ultimately allowed the law to go into effect. And then it was the decision was appealed to the Supreme Court, and they chose to take the case. So it's a little bizarre and it's a little strange. And all my lawyer friends are like, "Do you know how rare that is?" I said, "Yeah, it is." But I mean, from my standpoint, it's just a matter of being willing to put my name out there and my experience and stand up for these patients, and, you know, continue moving forward in that direction.
You say that like it's just like it's an easy decision to make, but I'm sure that you had to like talk to your family and your friends, because that puts you, you know, in the crosshairs of people who are looking to, you know, weaponize this information and looking to find targets, you know. And as a Black woman, that's an often a favorite target of people like that. So I would imagine you had to sort of, there was some sort of gut check or talking to your people. And what was that like?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So I started, like I said, providing trans care about 8 years ago. About a year afterwards, I have four children, all assigned male at birth, and I have a set of fraternal twins that are in the middle. They're 23 now. And so one of my children came out as trans. And it was a little not surprising exactly, but it definitely was not something that we had ever really talked about. It also wasn't something we'd ever really had any issue with. My ex-husband's a pediatrician. And so both of us were like, okay, great. You know, at that point I had been providing care for a year. So, you know, I was very familiar. But then I thought about it from my child's standpoint, not so much in the enacting of this law, because my child is now over 18, but, you know, obviously just seeing these patients and dealing with the families, dealing with the parents a lot, which is, you know, nice because I come at it from a perspective of both a doctor and a parent. And so I talked to my children. My children are like way more like gung-ho activists than I am even sometimes. So they are all supportive, and my ex-husband, and we've had conversations about things like this before. And, you know, we just all kind of feel very strongly that you have to be smart, you have to be safe, but the whole point of intimidation is to silence people and to make people afraid. And and so I just, you know, it wasn't really a difficult decision. I mean, one of the things is I'm independent. I have my own practice. And so while I have, you know, a faculty appointment at the University of Tennessee, I'm not employed by the university. And a lot of people that are, particularly medical professionals, are sort of limited in what they can do. And so I was sort of somebody who had that ability. It really wasn't a difficult decision. My family was all very, very supportive, and I have a lot of friends. And even Memphis, you know, we think of it, those of you who've never really been to the South or haven't spent much time here, you think of it as being very different. But Memphis itself is a pretty supportive environment, and there's a very, very robust LGBTQ community. And I have a lot of friends. And so I felt pretty supported in general.
So Nava, when you hear that, like, I would imagine hearing that, like, that the doctor's trans child had two doctors as parents, one who's a pediatrician and one who's in the middle of who actually works in gender-affirming care. That's got to be, not every trans child has that good fortune. What do you think when you hear that?
Yeah, I mean, what a blessing. What a blessing to have that family. I think that so often what we see is rejection of trans children. And what we've seen over and over again is that it makes all the difference in the world for a child to be accepted and loved by their parents. So I'm so glad they had you both.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was great. And of course, my other children were very supportive as well. But, you know, I end up with my kids, because now I can't treat minors, of course. Although even when I did, and I'm sure you'll ask me about that, it's always done with parental consent for minors. So the parents were part of that conversation. But I have a lot of, you know, young people that are, let's say, 18 to 25, let's just say. And, you know, there's a little bit of feeling that, you know, if they don't have parental support, they rely on us. And one of the things that's great is my staff is very supportive. And, you know, we try and really create our office to be a really relaxed and comfortable, safe space so that they can come in and feel like, even if they don't get that support from somewhere, they're going to, you know, they have a couple mamas here that are supporting them. And so, you know, that happens a lot as well.
Yeah. Even the name of your practice, it's called More, M-O-R-E. And it says on the website that the philosophy is to provide more ... Like, so what does that mean? How does that sentence end? What is the more?
Well, you know, and we've gone through some different iterations. So the original name was Modern Gynecology and Reproductive Health. We now go by More 901 because the more piece has become even more relevant. But I think one of the things that I see a lot, and it's not just with my trans patients, I treat a lot of patients for hormonal management, like menopausal patients, even a few cis male patients. But what I hear is not dissimilar, which is, I'm going and I'm talking to these doctors, like these menopausal women. They come in and said, I'm miserable. My brain's not operating. I'm foggy. I'm not focused. And I can't get people to take me seriously, right? And unfortunately, I think, you know, in healthcare, there's such a, doctors are getting busier and busier and time is getting less and less. And that's very hard on the physicians as well. And so one of the things that we just want to do is be a space where, you know, we'll provide you more time, more compassion, more consideration, more opportunity to make sure that your concerns are heard. So all of those types of things, no matter what the issue is, because it might be an 18-year-old trans person starting their medication, and it might be a 45-year-old woman is going through menopause and her kids are getting ready to like go to high school and college and she's pulling her hair out. And it doesn't really matter. That person just needs the opportunity to be heard and then have an approach that does everything it can to address their concerns. And so that's really kind of the philosophy, is to just provide those things that maybe you're not getting somewhere else.
So we're going to do some definition of terms just for the people in the audience who may not know some of these things. And also, so I could love to have you both sort of comment on what the actual meaning is versus the dictionary definition. So transgender is defined as having a gender identity that differs from the sex you were designated at birth. What does that actually mean, Nava, to you as a person who lives this life and is not a dictionary? And what does that mean to you, Dr. Lacey, as someone who's practicing this healthcare? Like, what does gender identity mean to each of you? And why is that important?
I mean, well, I think if now we got to define gender identity. because we all have a gender identity. I think that is something people may not understand or know about themselves. And it's just that in our world, in our heteronormative, cis-normative world, cis people often have not ever had to interrogate their own gender identity. And it's only people who deviate from the norm that are forced to have to contend with that. So that's, I think, where the need for terminology came from, for trans people to be able to identify ourselves and to explain our experience to other people. But at the end of the day, we all have a gender identity. And so, my gender identity, in one sense, it is woman, the same way that a cis woman's gender identity, it can be woman. There's the type of woman that I am, which is a trans woman, which I think gives more detail and is more specific to my gender experience. And I actually, that definition of transgender that we've kind of landed on generally feels very useful to me. It's broad enough and yet specific enough, because I think that there are non-binary people now who have come into the public consciousness. And again, we've always been here as trans people. And so non-binary people have always existed. It's just that the term for non-binary, I think, really surged into more common consciousness in the past few decades. But I think it's up to every person to decide whether or not they identify as transgender. And I think that that definition kind of allows for that.
Yeah. The term, I mean, you all may know this, but the term trans and cis is basically a chemical term.
I don't actually know that. I just want to be clear. So, I want to own my ignorance. I did not know that.
So, in chemistry, and when you're talking about chemical bonds and chemical compositions, if the bond or the chemical composition or the chemical piece, let's just say, is on the same side, it's cis, and if it's on the opposite side, it's trans. And so that's where the term came from, meaning cisgender, meaning your gender and your sex align, and transgender meaning that they are different or opposite. Those little prefixes are scientifically based in terms of where the language came from. And I think that as somebody who came to providing this care, midway through my career, I think that the language is changing constantly. And I always say, listen, this is an area where language is changing. And we need to allow ourselves to be led and informed by the people who it affects. But I think that it is good terminology because it's fairly simple. it's amazing how hard it is sometimes for people to understand, because they just get really caught up in that. They also get very caught up in how that relates to sexuality, which you know, is a very different thing. And so, you know, I think that terminology is good. I mean, in terms of being fairly simple and something that people can understand.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I feel like so much of this, like you said, boils down to people's inability or disinterest in learning new things after a certain point in life. So, Nava, I think you mentioned the phrase gender dysphoria, and everything we're saying, I think, applies to gender dysphoria in this part of the conversation. But can we just get like and Dr. Lacey, if you want to take it as the scientist, just what gender dysphoria is for people who aren't sure about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the medical diagnosis, if you use, you know, for, you know, a diagnosis for treatment, first, there is no psychiatric diagnosis anymore for gender dysphoria. It's been removed from the DSM. I can't remember which one, 10 or 11, I can't remember which one it is, but it's the Diagnostic Statistic Manual for Psychological Illnesses. So it is no longer part of that. But as a medical diagnosis, it's basically where you have sort of ongoing fixed stress, anxiety, negative thoughts related to the disconnect between sex and gender is probably the best way to describe it. And we were talking about minors, it has to be of 6 months duration or more. So you have to have had this, again, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about, and not immediacy of the treatment is there is sort of a time frame built in that it has to have existed for a period of time in order to qualify and categorize as gender dysphoria.
Nava, what are your thoughts? And so I know you are a peer counselor for LGBTQ youth survivors of violence. Can you talk about your time there and also gender dysphoria? When you hear that term, what you think?
Yeah, that was a beautiful explanation, Dr. Lacey. I think that I think I can maybe offer an expansion also on what anxiety can be. You know, it's not just like discomfort. You know, it can really be incapacitating. I remember growing up, clothing was always such a battle, and we could not figure out why, you know. I ended up having severe body image issues, and I developed an eating disorder that I had to deal with for about 10 years. I went into treatment. I dropped out of school. And later on, I realized how much of that probably had to do with the baseline of dysphoria. I almost can't even put myself back in the place of what my day was like before I transitioned or early transition of when my dysphoria was so high. It's like every moment kind of throws you off because you're expecting, you know, like the mirror surprises you and your own body sort of betrays you. So it's like this constant, like hitting a wall. I don't know if people can't understand what that means. I would hope that they can just trust that we're telling the truth. my work with survivors was, you know, some of the most meaningful and fulfilling work I've ever done in my entire life. I got to work with people from all walks of life and in lots of different points of their journey in terms of transition, in terms of identity, and also in terms of whatever violence they were dealing with. And what was most meaningful about being a counselor was that it was a healing space. It was a generative space. It was a space where we got to explore options, where we got to discover resources. We got to practice tools and skills. And so every single person that I worked with, I can say that we got at least from point A to point B, and a handful of them we got from A to C. And so to witness that kind of movement, it was so inspiring, and it's something I'll carry with me forever. And I think is also kind of a beautiful poetic allusion to what it means to transition, you know, whether you go from A to B or A to Z, that work to me is all the same.
Yeah, I just want to, just you said at some point, if you don't believe, just trust us. You said if that doesn't make sense, you just trust us. But I just want to say, anybody, I feel like we all, separate from trans folks, just as humans, have had moments of like, I don't feel like myself, or I don't like what I see in the mirror. And not to say it is the same as gender dysphoria, but I think that like anybody who is denying the realities of gender dysphoria is also denying themselves. But also, you live in a world where, like, I think about my mom, again, who's 87. She's been colored, Negro, African-American, Black. You know what I mean? So, like, we are very used to in society going, like, these words don't fit anymore. Let's figure out some new words that fit better. So I think that that's the way I always think about it, is that we are very used to, you know, learning new words if we want to. And we just have, it's the want we have to create.
Right.
Yeah. So let's talk about the kind of work you do, and both of you can weigh on this, Dr. Lacey, but just the idea of, like, I think there's a lot of misinformation about what medical interventions are for gender identity. And you said you can't treat children anymore, but there's a ton of misinformation about kids going to doctors and telling them whatever, and the doctor just doing it, and, you know, all sorts of medical. Can you talk about what medical interventions there are available, who they're available for in a place where they are legal, unlike where you're at. And and then also, Nava, let's start with you, Nava. What did it mean to you? You said you transitioned in Oakland. What did it mean to you to be able to do that in Oakland?
Yeah, I always say that I actually transitioned twice. In college, when I was 19, I started identifying as genderqueer. And then later, when I lived in Oakland, I transitioned again, and I came into my womanhood. And that was when I first made a medical transition. And I did not expect it to happen. I remember the weight of dysphoria just really starting to crush me, and me feeling so disappointed in myself that I couldn't pick myself back up. And it was very disorienting. I had graduated from college and I was now trying to fit myself into a very binary world. And it was clearly not working. And so it took me having to take it one step at a time. And then once I discovered that transition was even possible, it's like the fog lifted. It happened almost immediately. And then my life changed. I started to be, you know, assumed to be a cis woman in daily public life. And that was not something I had ever expected or prepared for. And so it was just a lot of change, but it was like, it was like the grass really was greener on the other side. And so transition is what allowed me to launch my career. I was able to finally write. I directed a film. I could envision my future. I had been so stuck in just getting through every single day and having to push through the muck of dysphoria before I transitioned. And so I just would not be able to be who I am and do the work that I do, let alone, you know, be a part of other people's lives the way that I am if I had not transitioned.
Mm. What do you think when you hear that, Dr. Lacey, with all the work you do?
Yeah, no, there's I even jotted myself down a few things to like dovetail because it's so important and so similar to things that I hear. And, you know, I always like to also say that, you know, my experience is not, it's not a first person experience, right? I am a mother and I have patients. I think the thing that's interesting is I see, you know, now I've treated probably somewhere in the range of 700-800 people. I mean, give or take thousands and thousands of visits. So I get, I get a lot of experience from a lot of different people, which is, you know, interesting to sort of distill. But first, let me sort of address the issue of the process of care. So the thing is, when patients first come in to see me, no matter how old they are, the first step is to understand kind of what their journey has been until this point. That's super important. Like, what are their expectations? What have they read? You know, when these younger people come in who are very savvy and connected to all the access of YouTube, social media, TikTok, Instagram, everything, they, you know, I have to understand what their expectations are. And with minors, and I had never treated prepubertal minors because I think that's something that you really do need a pediatric endocrinologist. Most of my minors were 16 to 18, sometimes a little bit younger. First off, they always had parental consent. Secondarily, we always required them to have had a therapist assessment. Everybody that does trans care, particularly for minors, is all on the same page. We're not trying to make it excessive. So, you know, that can require sometimes puberty blockers, hormone blockers, and then adding the hormones that are appropriate for that person. But that's a process. And so the most important thing, which I thought was really great, you said, Nava, was it is a process and it is a transition. And when I see these patients, sometimes I have to remind them that we got to take it one step at a time. And so the first step of the journey is obvious, is often the hardest, which is coming to even come in to see me, right? That can be years and years and years. Then the next step is, well, now we're going to talk about the hormonal piece and we're going to focus on that for a while, because I think that's really crucial. And then, you know, it isn't for everybody. For some people, that's not necessary. But for those that are sitting in my office, of course, that's a big part of it. And then once we've gone through that, then we can maybe start talking about some surgical interventions. But that doesn't happen off the jump. And it doesn't happen with minors ever. I mean, there are rare exceptions. But the concept that somebody's walking into my office at 15 years old and we're scheduling them for surgery the next week is so not what happens under any circumstances. And so, you know, that's the one thing, is the process. The second thing that you said that I thought was so interesting, because it was one of those things the scientist in me really responded to when I started providing care, is that fog lifting. And I stole this from a patient with permission, because I've been trying to find a good explanation. And this was about a month ago at a patient who said, I felt like I was a Mac trying to operate on a Windows operating system. And I just think that's so great. I was like, oh, I said, can I steal this? Because I'm going to use it every time now. But like, that was the thing that really was so compelling when I started providing care, was that the patients would come back and they were different ages, different races, masculinized hormone, feminizing hormone therapy, non-binary. And they would say, I finally feel like my brain's operating right. I finally feel like I can think clearly. And when I tell other physicians that, and other healthcare providers, it is always a little bit of a light bulb moment. It's almost like, you know, I've done a lot of lectures and they're sitting there kind of half listening, and then they all perk up. And I'm like, this is a brain chemistry thing, at least in many, many patients and many, many people. And so when people finally feel like their brain is operating correctly, then it leads to that access to their emotions and allows you, like you said, now to be more creative, to be more yourself. And so many people tell me, oh, well, I finally feel like I maybe cry more, but it's because I'm tapped into my emotions. Like, I'm tapped into who I really am. And then it allows them to live and be a more fulfilled person. So when I look at it that way, I just am like, it's hard for me to understand the objection to care, because when you see people go from somebody who felt really restricted and really like they were fighting against themselves to being able to be somebody who is flourishing in their career, it's just like an amazing thing to be able to be part of.
I don't mean to call you out, Nava, but there was a lot of head nodding. There's a lot of head nodding. Oh. You're a lot of active listening.
I'm like, oh, you're such a good doctor.
Yeah, it really the operating system metaphor I think is so apt. That is what it feels like, and I don't know. I think I was feeling just a sense of awe and pride at how trans people make it through. I did go to college before I transitioned. And so it's like our brains still work and we still get through, but it's even more impressive that we managed to do that, any of that prior to transition, because you're right, there is just something that clears up and a path that opens after transition. And I think that is what I wish more people who maybe are ignorant or even, have negative opinions over transition and trans people in general, is that I transitioned because I was so out of sorts physically and mentally and I was so restricted. That word also stood out to me from what you were saying. And why wouldn't we all want a community, a society where people are invited to and supported in thriving? That only betters everyone. And I think that is ultimately what we're talking about here, is people's abilities to survive and thrive.
Yeah. Well, and one other thing I was going to say, the other hat that I wear, which I do a lot of, is hormonal management for cis patients, predominantly like perimenopausal, menopausal women, some men as well at that age. And the newest drug that came out for menopausal women affects an area in the brain where there are estrogen receptors that are depleted. And these women come in and they say, of course, the things we hear about, hot flashes, night sweats, all of those things. But a lot of it is brain fog and focus and, of course, energy. And so we're sitting here making medications now to deal with the fact that we have a hormone deficiency in the brain, right, that is affecting people. So how can we not understand that there's an effect on the brain of hormones? And, we are maybe not capable yet of really understanding that complexity. But that is kind of, it's in some ways, it's a similar story. I hear the similar thing. And so it's been really fascinating for me as somebody who has always found hormones interesting to see how the two have intersected and impacted on one another in a lot of ways.
So, I want to just end this on talking about the future. I mean, this country is I don't know if it's even at a crossroads anymore. We're headed a certain direction there. The outcome of the case that you're a plaintiff in, Dr. Lacey, there's in the hands of 9 Supreme Court justices. And then also we have a president-elect who said he'll sign an executive order telling every federal agency to cease the promotion of sex or gender transition at any age. Now, just because our leaders say this doesn't mean that we have to sit back and let this all happen. Can we talk about what you would want people listening to this right now to do to help support the rights of transgender youth and transgender folks overall? And let's start with you, Dr. Lacey.
Oh, yeah, that's a big question. I mean, I think the most important thing is to be open-minded and, like Nava said, listen to people and believe them. That's where it all starts. I mean, just like you see if somebody has a gay family member or a trans family member, all of a sudden they become a lot more, thoughtful and open because they've seen it and it's no longer other. And so I think that's the most important thing. I mean, I think that, it is a really, really, really slippery slope to be able to legislate what medication someone can take and say, well, this person can take, like my menopausal patient can take it, but my trans patient can't. Unfortunately, I'm concerned about that. Is that going to be possible to actually legislate and say that, particularly with adults, you can't be prescribed a medication to be used for for whatever the purpose is, if that medication exists and is available? I think that we're hopeful that we won't come to that, but I think that we're going to need more and more you know, allies. And when I say allies, it's really not enough to just sort of passively support. We're going to need people to be more vocally out there and supporting it, and supporting their, transparent. I have a story. I'll tell you, I like analogies and stories, but I have a story where I have a very good friend who's an orthopedic surgeon. I've had ACL surgery. I've had a thumb surgery. And he was telling me one day about how he had a patient he'd seen for years who came in for a knee replacement. And when they went to do the knee replacement, this person was under anesthesia, and they went to put a catheter in, and maybe they didn't realize they were going to have a catheter. And they realized this person was a trans man. He didn't know. Nobody knew. And I kind of looked at him and I said, well, that's your fault. You know, I said, I'm going to call you on that. I said, because what a terrible, scary place for someone to be. What is more vulnerable than being under anesthesia in an operating room? Like, where you have no control. And all of a sudden, these people in the operating room discover this about you. I mean, I said, that's a failure on the physician's end. And he's a good friend of mine. We had a good conversation. I said, so you need to ask everybody this question. Like, that's one of my missions, is like, these need to be part of every EMR. Ask everybody. And I said, so that you are making sure that you are doing what's best for your patients. Your orthopedic surgery, you're not providing hormones, you're not doing trans care, you're not doing gender conforming surgery, you're doing a knee replacement. And so that's really, I think, going to be very important, is for, you know, in the healthcare sphere, to make sure that we are asking people and understanding where they come from, because they still, even if it's not coming to me for hormone management, they still need general health care, right? And so, you know, that's one of the areas that I'm very, you know, I feel very strongly about. What happens? I mean, I think we're going to have to see. I don't really know the answer to that. I do think it's going to be extremely difficult to take away the ability to get medical care for adults. Not saying it's impossible, but I think it's an extremely slippery slope, because if that happens, then you can legislate anything. You can say you can't be treated with contraception. You can't be treated. You can legislate anything if that's possible.
Thank you. Nava, what do you think about the future? What homework can we give the people listening to this?
I think that we cannot abandon each other. Step one in doing that is not abandoning yourself. So much of what it takes to resist an environment that is oppressive, that is repressive, is about trusting what you actually know, in your soul, what you actually know from your own upbringing, and from what you can feel when you're with people in person in front of you. And that is the human spirit. We have to hold on to that. We cannot let that be extinguished. And if we are able to hold on to that, that light will never be extinguished. So, we have to trust that and not all of the. Thank you for the reminder that we're on the ACLU. Podcast all of the nonsense. I'm going to say nonsense.
There you go. That's the legal term. That's the legal term. Nonsense. Yes.
That is thrown our way, that is meant to distract us, that is meant to disorient us, and is meant to divide us. We have to resist all of that on a psychological and on a spiritual level.
I just want to say thank you to both of you for taking time out of your busy schedules and out of your advocacy and out of your lives to do this. I really appreciate it. Thank you for being open to having this conversation with me, and also having this conversation with each other. I think it was really great to hear this conversation from this different perspectives, but pulling in the same direction. So I think it's really helpful for people to hear that. And yeah, thank you for joining me today. And we could keep going on, and there's more work to do and more to talk about. And we will certainly keep going. And thank you for being an example to me to remember how to better support all of my community.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of At Liberty, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and rate and review the show. We really appreciate the feedback. And just give us 5 stars or whatever the top review is. Just come on. This is ACLU. Don't be weird. Until next time, I'm W. Kamau Bell. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU. This episode was produced by the ACLU's Jessica Herman-Weitz, Gwen Schroeder, and Cindy Tsai. And Who Knows Best Productions, W. Kamau Bell. That's me. And Kelly Rafferty, PhD. And my wife, Melissa Hudson Bell, PhD. The show is recorded at Skyline Studios. I'm looking at Brian right now with my loving eyes. And it was edited by the folks at Ultraviolet Audio. And remember, friends, don't let friends give up the fight.